Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Hello and welcome to Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is hosted by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting and sponsored by Microsoft, makers of Notepad, Paintbrush, Calc.exe, and, Windows, those guys. Before we get stuck into this week's show, there's a couple of events you listeners might be interested in hearing about. There's an OWASP Day coming up on the 13th of July in Auckland, New Zealand. So if you Google for OWASP New Zealand Day, you will find it, and you should register pretty quick smart. I think they say they're going to cut off regos on June 20, but I suspect they'll extend that date a little bit. It's a free event with two parallel streams, Snicker, so go check that one out. There's also a new one-day event for those of you who work in fraud-prone industries. It's the E-Crime Symposium, which will take place in Sydney on August 4. Speakers include David Batch, who's the trust and safety guy from MySpace Australia. We've got the CISO of Woolworths. We've also got a QC from the New South Wales Director of Public Prosecutions, the Chief Security Officer of the Commonwealth Bank, and on it goes. So it's a nice event for those of you out there who are in more management-focused roles. It's not so much a technology conference, it's more a crime conference. So head to ecrimesymposium.com to have a look at the lineup and to register. That one is a commercial event, though. Now, this week's show is a cracker. We have a very special guest, which is Senator Stephen Conroy. The Senator is Australia's Minister for Broadband, Communications and the Digital Economy, and I caught up with him in Sydney last week to get his take on what he feels the role of government is when it comes to IT security. We're also joined by Sydney-based security consultant Jason Edelstein, who will be chatting about telephone-related fraud. US authorities have just busted up a massive ring of telephone fraudsters with links to Islamic fundamentalists, of all people. And over a period of years, they hacked into something like 2,500 systems, phone systems that is, and resold access via calling cards. Now, apparently, that netted them an estimated $55 million, US dollars, which is certainly better than a kick in the proverbials. I'm sure you will agree. We'll also check in with Stuart Strathdy from Microsoft in this week's sponsor interview, and Stuart's popping in to talk about Zero Day. There have been some really scary O-Day bugs in Microsoft products lately, and Stuart is popping in with his take on the situation, and it's interesting, actually. He argues that Office O-Days are actually pretty far down on the ye olde risk register. I'm curious to hear what you all think about that, and I'll be inviting listeners to dial in with their thoughts after that interview. So that is coming up later. But first, of course, it is time to check in with Adam Boileau in New Zealand with a look at this week's news headlines. And Adam, it looks like authorities in several countries, according to Wired Online, Wired News, they've busted a whole bunch of guys who are running some sort of phone hacking ring where they'd get into corporate phone systems and then resell access to those systems through calling cards and stuff.
Yeah, I guess it's nice to see people using these old school techniques to make money in the modern world. The news story goes apparently that, they hacked, 2,500 corporations' PABXs and then resold, $55 million worth of phone service through those, which is not a bad effort.
That's a pretty decent haul. That was over 4 years, 2,500 corporations in the US, Canada, Australia, and Europe. And it looks like, $55 million clams, man, which is a pretty decent haul. I could handle making $10 million a year, or 12.5 or whatever.
Yeah, and that's a lot of phone minutes.
By the looks of things, they've also linked this scam, at least in part, to people who also have links in turn with extremist organisations in Pakistan and Afghanistan, which is a little bit nasty. Yeah, interesting. Definitely a global setup and a pretty organised group of people.
I note actually that the article said the hackers themselves only got about $100 per hacked phone network. So I guess they didn't make the $55
million. No, certainly not. And even with 2,500 systems compromised, that's what, $250,000 over 4 years, which is, come on, man. These guys should get jobs doing audits and they'd make heaps more money.
Maybe PCI, that'd be where they should aim for.
Yeah, PCI audits. Look, we're going to actually cover that story off in more detail a bit later on. We've got Jason Edelstein from Sense of Security coming onto the show to talk about that one in a little bit. So we'll just move on to the next story. And look, this is more of the same sort of stuff. This story comes to us via Dark Reading. A new SQL injection attack compromises more than 40,000 websites, blah, 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 same old, right?
Yep, this sounds like same old to me. It's kind of depressing that it still works so well, you know, if another 40K box is owned.
Well, the funny thing is, I remember, I think it was last year when we saw just an astronomical number of SQL injection attacks being automated and used for this sort of thing to put malware on those sites and then, you know, deliver them up drive-by style to browsers. What I find interesting is a lot of the commentators said at the time that those early sort of automated attacks would probably have the effect of wiping out a lot of these SQL injection bugs. But here we are a year later and doesn't look like that's worked.
Well, I guess the developers are still still writing them faster than we can exploit them, huh?
Yeah. Look, it certainly looks that way, which is, I guess, good for the bad guys, but not so good for everyone else.
Yeah, well, I guess it's just a function of, you know, how many crap web developers there are versus how many hackers there are.
Yeah, and I guess it's pretty difficult to justify a sort of secure development lifecycle style, you know, development process for a site that doesn't actually handle any critical data. So they'd be the ones that I'd suspect would be getting most of the action in this case. It's just, you know, Bob's Restaurant's online menu or something.
Yeah, and in the end, serving up malicious content to somebody else's browser doesn't really hurt the people who've had SQL injection bombs, right? They don't have any particular incentive to fix it, I guess. So, yeah, that's probably a fair call.
Yeah. Now, of course, the pre-Black Hat press hysteria and press releases have started going out, and this looks like a pretty interesting little thing that's going to be released at Black Hat, which is an SMS hacking tool based on the iPhone platform.
With a shiny GUI, so very hip.
Yeah.
Black Hat marketing guys, they're smooth, man, smooth, I tell you.
Smooth like silk. Now, tell us about it, man.
Apparently they're releasing a tool that does some manner of SMS attacks and auditing of other phones. There don't seem to be any details of exactly what the attacks are. And so I think that will be the interesting thing more than the tool. I mean, I'm sure it will be shiny and pretty and have, you know, Web 2.0 reflections. But, it'll be interesting to see exactly what the vulns are and how bad they are. Like, if we release the code exec on phones, right, that's obviously a pretty important thing because nobody patches phones. SMS is a very good attack vector because it's always available, it's always on, it's globally available. It's not like you can firewall your phone off, no one patches. And indeed, patching is often very difficult when you have carriers that are, try to control the firmware on phones quite tightly. I think it will be one to keep an eye on.
Well, it is interesting because SMS these days isn't just a text protocol. I mean, you've got different languages available. You've got pictures, sound, all sorts of stuff, courtesy of MMS. And you'd think that you would find a way to get it to parse your bad stuff the way that you want it to, hey?
Well, yeah. I mean, anytime you start introducing more complexity, then, yeah, there's the scope for people to get it horribly wrong when they implement it.
I guess we'll just have to wait and see when that tool comes
out.
Yeah,
in the end, it's one of these... you have to show us the code sort of things, right? Black Hat hype is just hype until there's real bugs.
Yeah. Pixar, it didn't happen, eh?
Exactly.
Moving on, another story comes to us via news.com, and Google is sort of being asked by all sorts of privacy advocates out there to force HTTPS across all of their services, which is, you know, it's kind of interesting and it's kind of like, yeah, that'd be really cool. But do you think these privacy advocates realize the sort of overhead that'd be putting on Google?
Well, I mean, I think they probably do. I mean, some of the advocates quoted in this this letter, included by people like Bruce Schneier, probably does have a reasonable understanding of the overhead of crypto. But yes, you have to have some sympathy for Google in terms of the scale of the operation and the amount of data and the amount of page loads and things. Anything that lowers the performance by 20% on Gmail is going to make people upset, I'm sure.
Well, you'd imagine it would cost Google a bit of cash to HTTPS absolutely everything across the board.
Yeah, well, I imagine it would blow a fair amount of CPU power doing all that crypto. I think it's a good move for them, right? And yes, they should take a leadership role in pushing crypto out to people. Certainly for Gmail, having it enabled by default, I think would be a very good move.
Yeah, well, you can actually go into your Gmail settings and tick a box that says always force HTTPS. So it's not like they don't offer it. I think it's just the question of making it default.
They should certainly move towards that. But I imagine that the engineering effort is probably non-trivial.
Yeah, just a lot more hardware, I'd imagine. A lot more cooling, a lot more this, a lot more that, a lot more money.
Yeah, well, I would be interested to see, you know, in a year or so's time when they finally do it, you know, to see what the numbers are like. Because I mean, doing that much crypto, you know, it'd be interesting to see the real overhead that it adds in terms of cost and, you know, and heating and that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, next up in this story, I think is kind of cute, actually, which is that people, you know, there's a lot of political activity going on in Iran. There's been an election, Ahmadinejad and an Ajad guy, the one. Damn those political leaders with the hard names. Ahmadinejad. That'll do. That guy, you know, the guy, Death to America.
Ahmadinejad. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, the guy. The Holocaust didn't happen, that guy. So he's, you know, won, apparently, in this latest election, and a lot of people are demanding a recount. There's huge political protests, and his blog is being DDoSed.
Well, sucks to be him. But no, it's interesting, I think, denial of service attacks being used in a political context. You know, people who aren't hackers, who are just, you know, regular internet users, actually carrying out, you know, attacks, and I put that in, you know, scare quotes. Well, I guess we wouldn't really consider it attacks, you know, because resource exhaustion is not very exciting. But no, it's interesting to see these used in a political context.
Well, it is, and while I don't think it's going to really have a big impact on the future political shape of Iran, it is. It's sort of a symbolic attack, isn't it? It's a
It's more about having the media cover it, and I mean, the fact that we're talking about it in Australia and New Zealand, you know, means that it works quite well.
And it's not just his blog, but it's the Justice Ministry and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and a few others as well. But you know, I just find it really funny that this guy has a blog. I mean, what does he write on it? You know, I bought a new coffee table recently. It's beautiful, but it has bent legs, and I keep stubbing my toe on it, and I think I'm tempted to sell it. Death to America.
Well, at least he isn't Twittering, right?
Well, yeah. Ahmadinejad on Twitter, yeah. I think Twitter's been identified as an enemy of the state lately. But anyway, look, interesting story. Moving on. And Microsoft is launching a $750,000 lawsuit over some click fraud that's apparently affected them and some of their clients. Now, what I find interesting about this is that click fraud is rampant and you just don't hear too much about it. And it's money for jam.
Yeah, well, you know, anybody who thinks that you can't defraud online advertising, you know, through click fraud, those sort of things, right, is crackheaded, right? It's just part of the way it works. And the only possible model for advertising providers is just to build it into the cost and assume that most people are honest. And that's what we've been doing, and that's gone on just fine. And, yeah, I guess the fact that we're only talking about $750,000, you know, when people like Google are funded entirely by online advertising, you know, that the model works just fine as it is. And, yeah, I guess, you know, Microsoft lawyers had to do something to keep themselves busy.
But, mate, I think, you know, really what I'm getting at here is that this is just the tip of the iceberg, and it looks like the people who they're going after weren't exactly the sharpest tools in the shed, if you know what I mean, in regard to the way that they were conducting the click fraud. I mean, anyone out there really with the right amount of skill could set up a click fraud network pretty damn easily that would make them a lot of cash.
That sounds like a good idea. Maybe I should set up a click fraud network and make a good amount of cash.
So I don't know. I think they're just going after these guys because they were dumb enough to be so obvious about it. But I don't know. And no one really wants to talk about it because it is a significant
the foundation
problem.
Of the whole, you know, the internet economy, really, isn't it? I mean, advertising is in the end how Google makes their money, and you know, Microsoft's obviously looking to that as well.
But how can you tell if a click is genuine? That's what I want to know.
Well, I mean, like, you can't.
No.
I mean, in the end, the best you can do is have an advertising model where you pay per purchase rather than per click. But that changes everything.
Yeah, it does. But who knows? Future stuff. Different topic. Yeah. And we've got a few more stories to get through. Now, this next one, a URL shortening service, which is the Kligs URL shortening services, got pwned over the weekend and caused 2.2 million links to redirect to the same site. Gee, I wonder who was behind this.
It's kind of sad. You know, you redirect 2.2 million links, you'd think you could point it somewhere amusing. But no, apparently it went to the Orange County Register newspaper rather than Goatsea or something entertaining.
Well, yeah, to be fair, I don't actually think it was the Orange County Register that did this, but some people have remarked that it could have been an attempt at a DDoS, which kind of makes sense.
Yeah, no, that seems a bit like a fairly plausible thing. I certainly can't think of any other reason why you would do it.
But have you noticed that Twitter, just because it is such a short messaging service, like everyone uses shortened URLs?
Yeah, they do. Yes, it's and I guess attacking these sort of services is a good way to attack Twitter users, and maybe it was a trial run for something else. I don't know.
Yeah, the other thing is too, you could pretty effectively cross-site script people with shortened URLs and stuff like that. They don't really know what they're clicking on.
Yeah, well, there's plenty of opportunities for redirecting people to places where they don't expect to be.
Now, sticking with Twitter, and it looks like a researcher plans to unveil a month of Twitter bugs in July, which could be interesting because I think Twitter remains a little bit untested.
Yeah, well, the article goes into some more detail to say that the bugs are actually not with Twitter itself, but rather with users of the third-party Twitter API. So places like TwitPic and TweetDeck are named. So there's been bugs in some of those services in the past and the way they interact with Twitter's API. So it'll be interesting to see what the bugs look like. But in the end, it doesn't really matter where the bugs are if they affect Twitter users.
No, it doesn't. And it's about time this little ecosystem got a bit of a stress test. So I like these month of bugs things as a concept. They tend to raise a bit of awareness and get a few people, you know, a few good people looking at bugs because they can sort of piggyback on the festival spirit of it all.
Yeah, well, I think it's good to kind of pull everything together, and especially something like Twitter, which, as you say, does need to be given a bit of a shake-up and maybe taken down a peg or two, I don't know.
Taken down a peg, man. I thought tall poppy syndrome was unique to Australia.
Yeah, and New Zealand, we have that too. All us Antipodeans have had the same problems, I believe.
Excellent. Well, Adam, that actually takes us to the end of the news. I understand you are actually home crook with the flu, so thanks.
Yeah, laying off the pork, huh?
Well, you know that joke. If you get an email that tells you not to eat tinned pork because of swine flu, don't worry, it's just spam.
That's appalling.
Yeah, I know, but I kind of get my chuckles out of it. But, mate, I know you're sick, so thank you very much for agreeing to do the news this week, and we'll have a chat to you again soon.
Cheers. Thanks very much, man.
Adam Boileau on the line from New Zealand there, and as you just heard, US authorities have busted up that group who go about the place poning phone systems and then reselling calls via calling cards. So we thought we'd get someone on the line to have a bit more of a detailed chat about that, and Jason Edelstein works with Sense of Security in Sydney and has more than a passing interest in phone security. And Jason, I'm sure you'd agree that this is a pretty big scam indeed, this one that's been uncovered.
Well, obviously, it's pretty major. We've known about this sort of problem for a number of years, and I think I've actually spoken about it on one of your shows previously. It's kind of nothing really new. When you see people out there at newsagents and so on sort of selling calling cards at, you know, a couple of cents per minute to weird and wonderful sort of countries, you kind of do wonder how they can offer services at that sort of pricing. And one way to do that, of course, is to actually steal the time from other people's phone systems.
Were you at least surprised by the scale of this particular sort of fraud ring? Because it did strike me as being exceptionally huge in dollar terms.
Yeah, the scale's absolutely massive. Most of the frauds, I guess, have come to our attention previously, and in local media is obviously a lot lower than that sort of number. We get calls, maybe a couple per month, where people have had fraudulent phone calls made on their phone systems, and typically they're sort of just below sort of $10,000 sort of mark. People pick it up fairly quickly on their phone bills. In some cases, the actual carriers notify the customers. In other cases, we have seen some instances where there have been sort of $50,000 or $100,000 or slightly more. But obviously, this magnitude is huge.
Now, Jason, I know phone systems have been an area of particular interest to you personally over the years, and you've done a bit of research on them. But before we did this interview, you told me, and I found this surprising, that there isn't that much demand out there in the marketplace for phone system, security auditing services. Is that right?
There isn't, and I think it's largely because phones are sort of seen as a commodity. People are used to the traditional sort of phones where you just sort of plug them in, and they're really not feature-rich. So they don't see a phone system as something that particularly, I guess, potentially could be taken over and used to make fraudulent calls and ring up a large phone bill very quickly.
Well, yeah, that was leading on to my next question. I imagine that organisations with security personnel, which would be typically your larger companies, they might pay a bit of attention to it. But I suppose we would see a lot more fraudulent activity in the small to medium enterprise space. Is that correct? Does that mesh with your experience?
Yeah, that definitely does mesh with our experience. We have done a fair bit of work with sort of large investment banks and multinational sort of organisations. And they seem to have sort of the telephone side of things fairly well under control, if they've considered it. The smaller organisations, they quite often just buy these phone systems from your local comms provider and have them, I guess, plugged in, and then they just use them and they forget about it. And quite often these comms providers don't know anything about security. And there's a lot of default options in most of these systems, which a lot of the hackers use to get into these systems.
Now, during a typical enterprise audit, and I'm talking your larger sort of organisations, is it a horror show, or have they generally, or do you generally not find that much?
We typically do find a lot of stuff, especially with the larger, more complex phone systems like the Avaya. There's literally hundreds or thousands of different settings that you can configure, and out of the box, none of that security stuff is really applied. I guess another interesting thing is that quite often they've got third parties that have integrated these systems and implemented them, and quite often they use the same passwords on different customers, which they use to maintain these systems and dial in and so on.
So if you get one, you get them all.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So what do you think needs to happen here? Do you think this is a case? I imagine that a phone system, it would be easier to secure a telephony system out of the box than it is to secure something as complicated as a computer network, for example. Do you think that the vendors need to play a more active role in ensuring that the stuff ships out of the box in a secure manner? Or do you think that's oversimplifying the issue somewhat?
I think that would go a long way to stopping this sort of problems that we see. Basically, if you want to use a particular function in a phone system, you should have to actually turn it on, not for all the features to be on out of the box by default. And obviously, things like default passwords, when you first configure the system, you should be forced to change all those sort of default passwords so people can't use them as a backdoor to get into the system and reconfigure it.
So do you have any advice for people out there in listener land in terms of some simple countermeasures?
Okay, in terms of simple countermeasures, one of the key things we recommend to our customers is that if they only do business with certain countries, they should only allow their phone systems to call those certain countries. A lot of the fraudulent phone calls are actually happening to certain countries like Middle Eastern countries, such as Jordan, Israel, Afghanistan, and so on. So if you know that you're not doing any business in those countries, you can actually block those particular codes on most phone systems so that those numbers can't actually be dialed. And so if someone does actually get into your phone system, they won't be able to dial those particular countries. Now, obviously, that's going to limit it somewhat. Also, if you don't, allow your users to do interstate calls and so on, that really limits, I guess, how quickly they can rack up a phone bill if someone does get into your phone system.
I also wonder, though, Jason, if that is a setting on the actual phone system, that's probably something that could be modified if the system is compromised. Or is this a setting that you can get on the phone with your carrier and say, hey, we don't want to allow our phone system to dial out to these places?
With some carriers, it can be blocked at the carrier level. Obviously, you want to implement some controls within your phone system so that people can't reconfigure it. So things like changing all those default codes. And if you do want to allow people to call certain countries and so on, but not on a wide-scale basis, you can usually put in things like authorization codes and so on that you need to type in before you can dial that number. The other key thing we see out there is that a lot of people get in through the voicemail systems. And it's most voicemail systems these days only have four-digit PINs, and we'd really recommend that you start implementing six-digit PINs and have account lockout type functionality in those systems.
That'd stop our good friend HD Moore coming along with Warvox and just wiping everything out.
Exactly.
All right. Well, Jason Edelstein, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business.
Thanks very much, Patrick.
Jason Edelstein from Sense of Security there with a more in-depth look at the issue of telephone system security. And moving on, now it's time for a very special guest. It's time for a chat with Australia's Minister for Broadband Communications and the Digital Economy, Stephen Conroy. Now, I think it would be fair to say that this guy is quite unpopular with most, or at least many, Risky Business listeners, because he's the one trying to introduce the compulsory internet filtering scheme here. It's an issue that's attracted a great deal of interest from the media in Australia, and it's been, in my mind, done to death. Now, I also don't really regard it as a security issue, so I didn't ask him any questions based on the filter. I'm going to leave that to all of the other really angry people who work for Fairfax News Corporation and the ABC, because they're the ones covering that. Now, I know a lot of you out there would have enjoyed listening to an interview loaded with tough questions about the so-called Great Firewall of China. But really, I saw this catch-up as a chance, an opportunity, really, to ask the senator about his views on information security, which is, after all, what this show is all about. Now, for those based outside of Australia, you might get a bit confused when he starts talking about the National Broadband Network. Really, what that's all about is the government here in Australia has decided to build a $43 billion fiber to the home network that will eventually be spun off into a private enterprise, probably publicly listed or whatever. But it's a government-funded initially project to really build that infrastructure. So that's what he's talking about when he mentions the NBN. Now, I caught up with Senator Conroy at the Over the Horizon Forum in Sydney last week. Now, that was held on the final day of Australia's National E-Security Awareness Week. And the Over the Horizon Forum brought together industry, academia, and government types all together to discuss InfoSec. So I started off by asking the Senator what he feels the role of government should be when it comes to all things InfoSec.
The government is an important player, but it can't do it by itself. This is such a fast-changing technology that it has to partner and work collaboratively with industry, with consumers, to develop this at the same time. The government does not try and pretend it has the solutions here. There are many different problems with many different answers, which is why we need the National E-Security Week, forums like we're having today, which bring together industry, regulators, the government. That's the critical aspect of what we're doing this week.
Would you agree that one of the problems, though, of trying to get collaboration across such a complicated area is it's that old saying that a moose is a racehorse designed by committee?
Look, I in general I agree, but the government readily acknowledges that we must work with the private sector and with the experts in the industry, because there's only one thing worse than a moose, and that's one entirely designed by the government.
So what does that collaboration currently look like? I mean, apart from various industry forums where government can interact with industry, are there any specific initiatives you can name where the government is really actively involved with industry in a sort of meaningful, big-picture way?
Well, last year's forum threw up a couple of ideas that have come to fruition this year, and we had a presentation this morning from Telstra about something they've been designing. We kicked off last year talking about we needed to work with the ISP community to work on a code of practice on how to deal with security issues for their consumers. And this week was the first of the formal meetings with consumer representatives, the ISPs, government, to start working through that process. So there are concrete things that are coming from these discussions, and this time next year, we would hope that code of practice is in place. So there are concrete things that are coming from these discussions, and we saw that from last year to this year, and we have high hopes that we'll see real developments come from the discussions this week.
Now, I note that we've actually appointed a sort of head of security in some regard in government. It was a DSD officer. I believe her name is Rachel Noble. Is that correct?
I'm aware the government made announcements in this area. I haven't met the individual yet. I look forward to talking with them. DSD are obviously the critical government agency that handles the national e-security issues. And we've been very conscious. We had, Cyberstorm 2, I think it was called. So the government has been working with particularly large companies to target critical infrastructure vulnerabilities and to work with AusCert to create the standards that we need to protect our vital infrastructure. So the recognition by the government in its white paper that the Prime Minister put to Parliament for the first time on national security statement was that this is one of the top 10 national security concerns. And that's why it's so important for us to draw on the expertise of the sector. I mean, one of the key messages I took out of the discussions this morning was that the criminals are becoming very well organised. This isn't some random Nigerian letter that you've received in the mail that you're responding to. This is organised internationally to try and milk Australians and to defraud Australians. We need a national and an international response, but we must understand that this is not something that is just a disorganised, there's a spam from someone that's pretending to be my bank. This is an organised industrial criminal activity.
In the United States, the Obama administration has put together this advisory panel that reports to the Department of Homeland Security, and it's a standing advisory panel. It's not sort of, I mean, this is more of an ad hoc sort of event. Is the government currently considering instituting anything similar to that?
Well, look, we've watched with interest what the Obama administration has done, and we thought that was a very good initiative. At the moment, a number of these issues are spread across departments, so I see some merit in having a very organised and orchestrated response. It's certainly something I'll be taking up with Rob McClellan, the Attorney General, who looks after national security. My department looks after consumer and small businesses. But I think there is some merit to having a conversation with Rob about, well, look, this is the sort of initiative that was very, very, very well received in the US. This is something we should have a talk about.
Very quickly, though, the flip side to that argument that government should be really involved in this area is that some people see the role of government in the information security arena as being twofold. One, to protect its own assets, and the other role is to prosecute, to investigate and prosecute offences, and that is all they should do. What's your take on that? Do you think that's a little bit too simplistic?
Look, I think that given the rapid pace of change, I think what we need is a government involvement, because the threats are growing. And with the national broadband network, it is better for us to build the security systems and embed them in at the beginning, rather than wait until after the problems emerge, and then you've got to try and put layer upon layer on top of the system. It is better to be engaged with industry now to build those security systems and protections into the national broadband network design at the beginning. So I think that is an old-fashioned, simplistic approach. We're currently working on the greatest transformation of the Australian economy seen since, you know, the Industrial Revolution, and we need to build the security in at the beginning. And that will enable us to have a better outcome down the track. If you look at what the internet was originally intended for, it has become so much more, which is fantastic. But the lack of security that were, or not even lack, it was a deliberate, we want anonymity, we want to give people maximum freedom. But what that's meant as we've moved into the 21st century and we've moved commerce online is that these ability to defraud people is growing at an exponential rate. So we must have an involvement at this early stage, particularly in the network design and the security issues around the NBN. They're absolutely paramount. So we want to have an involvement with the sector, and the government will need to be involved as we're the ones who are building it.
Senator Stephen Conroy in the flesh in Sydney there with a look at the government's role in information security. Next up, it's time for our sponsored interview with one of Microsoft Australia's resident security dudes, Stuart Strathdy. Now, as you all know, Microsoft has had a problem with zero-day vulnerabilities lately. You've seen various bugs in things like PowerPoint and Word popping up and hitting customers who've been more or less powerless to protect themselves. So I thought we'd get Stuart on the show to discuss this problem from Microsoft's perspective. I started off by asking him if he thought the increasing prevalence of zero-day bugs in the wild is the result of a fundamentally altered vulnerability disclosure landscape.
I think that we're seeing an evolution of the process. And, you know, there's certainly some speed humps along the way. But we ourselves have also, gone a long way in announcing new programs to try to rectify some of the issues that the industry's facing. And, you know, we've got to be agile. I mean, our adversaries in IT security, they've got a lot of resources. They're very fast to move. They're not concerned about international borders and that sort of thing. So the vendors at a global level have to be just as agile in their response.
And what do you mean by being agile? And also, what do you mean by introducing sort of programs? Because I would have thought this is a case where there's not really a lot you can do about it.
Yeah, so the first thing I mean when I talk about agility is that we can't get a mentality of the way that we've done things in the past being appropriate for, delivering security fixes and updates in the future. And we've seen that evidenced in the changes that we've seen in groups like the Microsoft Security Research Center and the way that they've really engaged with the security research community and tried to become, you know, active members in that community and build relationships there. And then we've also introduced programs to, you know, make us a little bit more agile and more responsive. One of the programs I'm thinking about was introduced at the Black Hat 08 conference. And that was the Microsoft Active Protection Program. And essentially what we do there is we're out there sharing vulnerabilities and discussing issues. And we've also got another program, the Microsoft Vulnerability Research Program, and that's where we share vulnerability details with third parties as it relates to their applications. And we also work in trying to support them in fixing those vulnerabilities as well.
So it's almost like Microsoft Cert.
Sort of.
So a bit of a clearinghouse is what I sort of meant by that.
Yeah. So, I mean, we call them programs, but the certs do a very similar role. And essentially, from our perspective, we look at a lot of the application vendors and we understand how broad their reach is across the industry and across our customers. And we've recognised that, you know, if a very broadly used application has a serious security vulnerability, then that's a problem for our customers as much as it is a problem for Microsoft itself. So we're obviously going to offer resources and also, you know, disclose vulnerabilities that we come across to try to secure the environment as a whole.
And it must be tough too. I imagine you guys would have put a lot of effort into working out mitigation strategies to deal with these sorts of things when a patch hasn't become available yet. Is that something that Microsoft is doing in a serious way, or is that just something that you've always done?
I don't think that has changed much over sort of the past 1 to 2 years. So we've always taken trying to find mitigations for our customers as a top priority. I mean, obviously, we're doing the work in investigating the actual vulnerability itself, but coming up with the mitigations is just as important until we can get the patch out. So I suppose this is somewhat of an extension of that overall investigation. And it's also a way that we're trying to actually say, you know what, we don't want you to have to go through two steps. So we don't want the customer, if we can avoid it, to have to put in mitigations and then to update with the update later on. If we can just work with the other vendor, or even, you know, if we can drive the update out faster ourselves, then it's always better to have the solution than to have to mitigate and then apply the solution later on.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is, though, you know, in the case of some of those PowerPoint bugs and Office bugs that were out there getting exploited in the wild, you know, there was a pretty significant window there before the patch got out. I mean, what can you tell customers? I mean, what can you say to a customer who's sitting there saying, I'm vulnerable, it's a vulnerability in a Microsoft product, where's our patch? Because I imagine you'd get a few phone calls like that.
Yeah, and we do. But one of the key things I think it's really important to remember is that, you know, 0 days are, they're always very newsworthy, and they make a good story because they are a, you know, they do represent a risk. But by far and away, the greater risk that we see in terms of actual customer impact is customers that haven't deployed our existing updates. So I'm not suggesting in any way that there's not a real threat, but typically the level of exploitation that we see of 0 days is quite low in comparison to, you know, the level of exploitation that we see of patches that may have been released many, many months before but haven't yet been deployed.
Well, I think our resident columnist, who we haven't heard from in a little while, Adam Metalstorm Boileau, once wrote that that's the way you win in a penetration test these days, is you roll like it's 1999 and own people with MS-040.
Exactly. You know, I would suggest to you that a very large proportion of my work is actually focused on assisting customers get up to date with existing patches. So whilst we do certainly discuss 0 day, and I mean, I don't want to be someone that always talks about over-the-horizon products, but we do have Threat Management Gateway that has some 0 day capabilities.
What do you mean by 0 day capabilities?
Okay, so the Threat Management Gateway, it's currently only in beta, but that product is going to have, if you like, a profiling system, so that once we see how a 0 day is actually being translated into, or how it's actually been weaponized, then we'll look to try to build a pattern of the attack and add that into the threat management
filtering. So it's basically an IPS that leverages your telemetry.
Yes.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
So in broad terms, I think that's a fairly fair comment.
Yeah, you mentioned that you know, for most of your customers, it really is a case of being brought up to speed on patches that came out, you know, a couple of years ago. But yeah. Wouldn't it be even just like that much more frustrating if you were one of the customers who actually does it right, TM, you know, and has all of the patches up to date, all of the desktops are sitting there swimming away, you know, humming. And, you know, the CSO's in there doing a terrific job of keeping everything up to date. And then that O-Day comes out. I mean, what can you do for people like that? Or are you just saying that people like that don't exist?
No, I'm not suggesting they don't exist. We certainly have. There are quite a number of customers that I can think of off the top of my head that are quite amazing in their patch deployment. But I think that someone who is that security savvy,
they're going to be able to work around the problem themselves, aren't they?
Well, I think there's a number of things. Number one, they understand that there are, you know, no silver bullets here, and that 0 days are always going to be a certain level of threat. Number two, I think they've probably already looked across their organisation and, you know, done pretty accurate sort of risk analysis. And they're probably looking at a 0 day in that sort of perfect world scenario. It's probably a fair way down their list of priorities. Now, that's just based on conversations that I've had with that sort of customer. Mm. And number three, they always have Microsoft as their backstop. So if we haven't seen it before, if it is something new, and look, occasionally our telemetry does pick up these sorts of things, then what we're able to do is we can work directly with them in trying to identify the problem and, you know, put in some filtering or some mitigation, whatever might be necessary.
Now, before we go, Stuart, I've just got to ask you one thing, which is, have you sent a case of scotch to your counterpart at Adobe? Because these guys are doing a really good job of taking the heat off you.
Well, Adobe is actually one of our key partners.
All right, Stuart, I'll allow you to cease being uncomfortable with that line of questioning, and I'll bid you farewell. Stuart Strathdy, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business, as always.
Thanks, Patrick.
Microsoft's Stuart Strathdy on the line there in this week's sponsored interview. If you have anything to say about this week's show, we'd love to hear it. You can call Sydney 02-8569-1835 or USA on 877-688-8417. Yeah, please ring up and leave a message, and that way we can include the audio of your message in next week's show. Call me. Call me now. Well, that's it for this week's show, and we'll take you out now with a track from Morph, who are a great Melbourne-based band who do a weird mix of sort of live dance music and acid jazz. It's pretty interesting stuff. They're always touring. I think they're in Europe at the moment. They're going to go over and play Glastonbury, which is kind of cool. So if you enjoy this tune, go check them out or check out one of their Australia gigs when they're back. And until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening to the show. See you next week. We'll be right back.